Hey cultists, welcome to another episode of Cult Classics, your monthly escape into the world of strange cinema. And it's September already, if you can believe that. We're almost into autumn, or fall, if you're stateside. Where did that year go? Regardless, we're here with yet another episode, and as you can tell from our opening and the thumbnail and description, with the sequel ready to drop in cinemas, we're going back to the original Tim Burton, Michael Keaton 1988 classic Beetlejuice. As always, I'm not doing this alone. This time we got more guests volunteer than I think for any other episode on the show. They all had to take a ticket and wait their turn. So as it stands, we've got a waiting room full of the haunted souls of podcasting. But first up, we have my regular co-host making another return appearance. He's sat here with a shrunken head looking very confused. It's Mr. Mike Wilson.
Hey, what are you doing? Hey, what are you doing, man?
Welcome Somebody said back. Mike three times and I turned up.
How's life treating you, fella?
It's all right. Actually, it's going relatively well for once at the moment. He said, touching wood, immediately afterwards.
Mate, I should rephrase that. You're beginning to sound like, you know, Tobias Funk.
I blew myself.
Nice one. Well, glad to have you here. Next up, you've no doubt heard her on this season's episode. She's our resident feedback expert, only this time she's hopped a sandworm over to the studio to discuss the movie at hand. It is the good lady, Vianne.
Hey, guys. I'm excited to talk about Tim Burton.
Nice one. As I said, you normally make an appearance to read out the listeners' feedback, but you're here for the movie itself this time. You're looking forward to talking everything about this one?
Oh, yeah. I have been a fan of this movie since it came out, and I've done a lot of reading up on the behind the scenes not for this particularly, just out of my own interest. And so, yeah, I'm eager to discuss it.
Nice. And finally, we have our blue-skinned showgirl all the way from LA. You last heard her on our 1941 episode earlier this year. It's Adrienne.
I myself am strange and unusual.
Nice.
How are things
with
you?
Hello, everyone. Hey. Hello, friends. I'm excited to be here. Yay.
Nice.
Yeah, let's talk about that guy with the mold on his face. It's disgusting. Let's go.
JK Rowling?
I'm right here.
Oh, but I'm bummed.
So, how are things with you? Your summer being a fruitful one?
Yes. Well, right. Never talk about tomatoes this time of year. This is a quiet month. It's really hot in Los Angeles right now. So kids are finally back to school this week. And I'm just looking around the house going, I'm sure there's a Star Trek episode I need to watch.
Always.
Well, it's awesome to have you back on this one. So nice to hear you again.
Very glad to be here, you guys.
Cool. Now, if you're a regular listener, you'll know that normally at this point we ask our guests their favorite cult movie. But seeing as our guests today are all old hats at this, I'm going to throw them a different question so we can see what makes them tick. So this time around, I'm going to drop the question. Are you a Tim Burton fan? And what's your favorite Tim Burton movie? And I'm going to go in reverse order. So I'm going to come to you first for this one, Adrienne.
Well, they're all good, but I think I'm going to give it to The Nightmare Before Christmas.
It's not a Tim Burton film.
Oh, okay. Well, I really liked Corpse Bride. It's kind of in the same vein, but I mean, if we're doing between this and Corpse Bride, then I have to give it to Beetlejuice.
Cool. So you would consider yourself a Tim Burton fan, yeah?
I always look forward to Tim Burton stuff. Always. And I'm always interested. A lot of times I get really obsessed with something. Like, I don't know what happened to me when Corpse Bride came out. I just let it play in my house for like 5 months. I don't know why. I just loved it. Shit. So, hey, let's say, you know, I guess so. But, you know, I was not a big fan of like the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory stuff. You know, that was not what I liked. So, hey, what are you gonna do?
No, that's fair enough. I'm with you on that one. So what about you, Vianne? Tim Burton fan?
I have a very complicated relationship with Tim Burton. I was the most avid Burtonite, oh my God, until I was in probably my early mid 20s from Pee Wee all the way through. Had everything he did. He was a huge influence on my art and on my aesthetic. And I just loved his work. And he kind of, you know, you get older and you get a little wiser to things. And I think he's one of those people who has a lot of good ideas, but once the industry and Disney in particular realized he was marketable, they just threw money at him. And he has for the last, you know, 15, 20 years been surrounded by people who just say, yes, every idea you have is great. And it's not. So yeah. I think, you know, he used to be this cinematic visionary and this amazing creative powerhouse. And now he just puts out crap. So, yeah.
She's describing Ridley Scott, DK, isn't it?
Well, it's happened to a lot of artists that they fall into the same thing where it's to buy their own press and then, you know, they just jump the shark and they just start putting out schlock. I haven't even seen, I think, his last two movies, and that hurt a little fangirl heart so much. But I mean, if we're being honest, plus, you know, some stuff, I try not to read up on people's, you know, personal lives and stuff, but stuff I've heard and seen that he has done in his personal life, I am just like, wow, you seem like a shit human being. So I have a complicated history with him.
He and his wife lived in separate houses while they were married. I mean, the signs were all red.
He doesn't have a great track record with the way he treats women, for sure. Which I don't have the space for that. But I will say, you know, I'm still an avid fan of many, many of his films, especially his early work. I think his masterpiece is Big Fish. I think that is as close to flawless filmmaking as we see.
Cool. Mike?
Complicated question again. Before Planet of the Apes, yes. After Planet of the Apes, no, is the answer to am I a Tim Burton fan? Although there has been the odd thing that have popped up post Planet of the Apes that I've enjoyed, even if other people didn't. Like, I didn't mind Dark Shadows. I thought it had a fun quirkiness to it.
I love Dark Shadows, Mike, so I'm with you on that.
Cool. You know, and obviously I loved Corpse Bride, which was after 2001. I'm with Adrienne on that one. And I am one of the very few people that really liked his take on Dumbo. I think it's one of the better live action remakes because, you know,
I'm with you on that one.
Thank you. Because, I mean, the original film was only like 40 minutes. So, of course, when you're remaking it and you've got to fill a 2-hour movie, you can do new things. And most people's always like, oh, The Jungle Book's the best because it's the least like the original movie. And I'm like, watch Dumbo.
Yeah. It's in which he literally gives the finger to Disney.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say, not only is it not unlike Dumbo, but it basically has a character in it who is a Walt Disney cipher that they're all basically like, this guy is evil. He is exploiting us. So, you know. That, and obviously I loved Wednesday, which I know is TV, but yeah, I was surprised to see him move into television, and I loved that, I've got to say.
I'm guessing from the sigh you didn't view.
Oh God, it was so awful. It was, I mean, visually gorgeous. I freely admit that, but the story was so moronic, I can't even. And here I was agreeing with you for once about Shadows, and then you had to go and say that.
Yeah, we'll get into this one, which is Beetlejuice, obviously. It's a 1988 American dark fantasy horror comedy directed by Tim Burton from a screenplay by Michael McDowell and Warren Scarron, based on a story by McDowell and Larry Wilson. The film stars Michael Keaton, for 14 minutes, Alec Baldwin, Gina Davis, Jeffrey Jones, Catherine O'Hara, and Winona Ryder. And the plot revolves around a recently deceased couple, and as ghosts, they're not allowed to leave their home, and they contact Beetlejuice, a charismatic bio-exorcist, to scare the house's new inhabitants away. It was released in the US on March 30th, 1988, by Warner Brothers. It was a critical and commercial success, which is unusual for our cult classics. It grossed $74.7 million on a $50 million budget, winning the Academy Award for Best Makeup and a trio of Saturn Awards for Best Horror Film, Best Makeup, and Best Supporting Actress for Sylvia Sidney. The film's success spawned an animated TV series, video games, a stage musical, and as we all know, the sequel that's coming out. So, as we always say, the movie can currently be found on various streaming platforms, depending on your location, as well as being available to purchase in physical format with the upcoming sequel on general release later this week. So, when did you guys first see this one? Because, I mean, I don't think I saw this at the cinema. I don't even think it was a rental. It's not that it didn't appeal, it never really crossed my radar. In fact, I think the first time I saw it is when it was shown on TV where I was. Luckily, we had the technological marvel that was a VCR at that point. So I recorded it, and it was a fairly regular rewatch. I was never what I would call obsessed, but being both a Michael Keaton fan and having a mad crush on Gina Davis at the time probably helped immeasurably. So how about you guys? When did you first see this one? And I'm going to come to you first on this one, Vianne.
Oh, when it came out. I was the youngest, so I got exposed to things that were maybe not intended for 3-4-year-olds. But I loved it, and it was a regular watch. I don't think we actually had the VHS tape, but we rented it all the time. And I love every minute of it, always have. I think the soundtrack is particularly strong, but I remember this was the 80s, of course, my parents had a waterbed, a king or a queen size. In my child memory, it was huge. And there was like 2 feet between the end of the waterbed and the wall. And they had the little tiny, like probably what, 12, 15 inch TV in their bedroom. And, sitting on the floor of the, in front of the waterbed on the floor watching, same place I was first exposed to Next Generation, by the way.
Adrienne?
But this was a find at Blockbuster Video, and I used to rent it all the time, and I remember having it, not wanting to give it back.
Nice one. So it made an impression straight away, yeah?
Absolutely. I think for me, it was the music. It was so interesting and different.
Cool. What about you, Mike?
I can't remember when I first saw it. It definitely wasn't when it was first released, and it probably wasn't for many years afterwards. I have a feeling it was probably after I'd seen the Tim Burton Batman films, but I did become briefly obsessed with Tim Burton's early stuff, and I think that is a great run. Pee-wee, Beetlejuice, Edward Scissorhands, Ed Wood, the two Batman movies, Mars Attacks. I was obsessed with all of those. So that's why I say I was a fan pre kind of 2001. So I know I did see it, but it probably, like you, I caught up with it on like a video rental or something.
With regards to the film, would you say it's one that any of you rewatch with any regularity? Is it one of those that you have to go to every once in a while?
It has kind of become a regular Halloween watch for me, just because I think it fits the tone kind of well. I usually watch a lot of horror movies on Halloween, and then I started thinking, you can't really start horror movies early in the day, but I can watch Beetlejuice earlier on. It's not too bad. So, for the last several Halloweens, I've been watching it.
No, that's cool.
So that's like your movie entree for the season?
Well, basically, I'll start off with Beetlejuice and then jump into the proper horror.
Have any of your impressions about it changed since you first saw it?
Mine has. When just watching it just these last couple of days, because eventually I did own the VHS and I used to just play it all the time, but I'd never seen it on a 4K or anything like that. I'd only ever seen this movie on VHS.
Finally watching it
on the big screen in my office, I can see much more detail, and it's just, there's so much more in it, but that was good. But one thing that's bad is, Lydia was a high schooler, I guess. And that's kind of, he was just kind of creepy. So for me now, I see the character as kind of, now that I'm older, that Beetlejuice was a creep, but he didn't have to be so creepy with Lydia.
Yeah.
I kind of said that to DK. I was like, of all of the things to get a kid's cartoon, they chose the film in which Michael Keaton gropes Gina Davis, looks up her skirt, goes to a whorehouse, then tries to marry a high schooler. And you're like, this will be great kids' television.
Yeah, but like I said, Mike, they did it with a lot. They did it with Toxic Avenger. They did it with RoboCop. Well, originally the plan came after Poltergeist was a hit movie. But the idea of Bad Ghost was flipped. The people that moved into the house would be the awful ones, and that's where the idea kind of came from. Yeah. So I'm just wondering what you guys think to the writing of this one. Do you have any standouts, or you know, anything that that you find particularly good about the writing or bad? It's completely up to you. You've already mentioned the Beetlejuice being a creep.
Yeah, just gonna say, watching it more and more now, like every Halloween and stuff, every year that goes by, it becomes more and more dated. It's an incredibly 80s plot that it's basically like these yuppies are moving into this lovely, little house in a village somewhere, sleepy village, and they're taking over and they're bringing all their technology and their mobile phones and whatnot. And it's kind of like, all right, this, when you watch it back now, it is very 1980s concerns, really, isn't it?
They cast so many improvisational actors. And so much of this movie that made it to the screen is actually improvised on the spot. So it's hard to give the writers credit for any specific thing without really, really knowing, was that their line or was this their plot point or was this something they kind of came up with in the moment?
I still really love the camp of it. I kind of love how they set Michael Keaton free to just be a gross guy. And goofy, but funny and clever, like the whole Juilliard thing where he's talking about his qualifications is just great.
I do like the, I've seen The Exorcist so many times and it just gets funnier every time I see it.
Yeah. Don't you think he must have had fun doing that scene? And how did everybody not crack up on set? I mean, I bet there were a million takes.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a couple of little interesting things. When Adam finds the advert for Beetlejuice, he actually does say the name three times, but because he pronounces it Betelgeuse, the incantation doesn't work. The test screenings were met with pretty positive feedback, and they prompted Burton to film an epilogue featuring Beetlejuice foolishly angering the witch doctor. But Warners disliked the title Beetlejuice and wanted to call the film House Ghosts.
Boring title ever.
I know. As a joke, Tim Burton suggested using the name Scared Sheetless instead, but then was horrified when the studio actually started considered using it. So, yeah, studio execs as reliable as ever.
Yeah.
So, yeah, with regards to that, Tim Burton's direction, what are your thoughts on that one? I'll come to you first, again, Mike.
This is very Tim Burton. The visuals and everything, and the way things, you know, look, a very specific aesthetic. I'm not particularly good at voicing, you know, what that means or the specifics of it, but I just know that it looks like, if you told me to pick the most Tim Burton film, this would probably be up there. You know, bright, garish colors and gaudy ideas, and even the incredibly practical special effects, you know, just reek of Tim Burton to me. Just a bit weird, a bit out there, but yet bright clashing colors that clash with the darkness, that kind of, as you said, humor but dark humor aspect. So I think it's definitely, as an auteur, you could definitely look on it as a very Tim Burton film, a lot more than some of his later, perhaps, you know, gun for hire type stuff.
Yeah. What about you, Vian?
He's visionary. I once read a quote about him where somebody referred to Tim Burton as a whirling dervish of creative energy, and that's kind of always stuck with me. I read that a very, very long time ago. And I think it's gorgeous. I think the direction is wonderful. I think visually stunning. You know, the juxtaposition of the everyday with the extraordinary. And like Mike said, the color scheme is, you know, unlike other Tim Burton works, it's not desaturated. It is full blast and just so beautiful. And the practical effects and the hard angles all over in the afterlife. And I just think it's really a work of art.
Cool. Adrienne?
I agree with Ben. I think that this movie is something that set designers probably love to inspect and, you know, look at these scenes, that these different sets. I mean, the total milquetoast stuff of the house when it first started, and they're like picking wallpaper and this has to go. And then the juxtaposition of when the Dietzes come and how they turn everything very dark and, you know, goth isn't really the word. I don't know. I'm sure there's some sort of design to describe what the Dietzes did, but I just think these sets are incredible. And I know that that isn't all about Tim Burton. I'm sure the set designers, but he had to have described his vision.
Yeah. I will be honest. I like some of Burton's movies, but I've never been completely sold on his artistic vision for things. So that when it came to this, I've got kind of a love hate with it. But having said that, I think I'm not sure. Was it you, Vian, that mentioned the afterlife?
Yes.
Yeah. When we see him go in the afterlife, there was a Tim Burton exhibition here recently, and I really regret not going to it because you could walk down that corridor.
Oh, that really cool, the narrowing corridor with like the Dutch angle come to life.
Yeah. So, during that sequence where they enter Juno's office and see her speaking to that you know, deceased football team, I never noticed it until this time. A movie theater full of ghosts can be seen through Juno's office window. Apparently in cinemas, it created the illusion that the living and the dead audiences could see each other and were kind of watching the film from different angles. I don't know if any of you guys picked up on that.
Well, now I have to go in and rewatch it.
Yeah, among the ghosts in the audience, there's a red skeleton and a green skeleton, which are pretty identical to the ones later seen in Mars Attacks. A woman with red hair and two men in suits and Ray-Ban-style sunglasses, like the Blues Brothers.
So, or the Men in Black.
Yes. Apparently, though, Burton did not like the Deor sequence. He didn't think it would go over very well because he didn't think it was very funny.
Huh.
So, but I do notice that when Glenn Shaddix, who played Otho, died in September 2010, the last song performed at his memorial service was the Banana Boat song.
Aww.
Yeah.
Well, he grabbed that ice bucket and he was really getting into it. So
he did love that. Yeah. And the scene, obviously, where Beetlejuice eats the fly is a tribute to the horror film.
Happy!
Gina, obviously, the other connection is Gina Davis starred in the remake of The Fly 86. Mm-hmm. And Michael Keaton was offered the lead role in that, but turned it down.
He was. I didn't know that. How different it'd have been.
That would have been weird.
Yeah.
Did you pick up on the fact that it's kind of a forward reference as well, because Vincent Price was in the original Fly, and he would obviously star for Tim Burton in later movies?
Yes, in famous Helene Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice one. Burton claimed it took a lot of time to convince the other cast members to sign after Keaton, as they didn't know what to think of the weird script. It's apparently Keaton's favorite role, and as Vian said earlier, he ad-libbed about 90% of his lines. According to him, Beetlejuice was described to him by Tim Burton as having lived in every time period but no time period. So, yeah, he said when he first showed up to the set as Beetlejuice, the crew was chanting "juice, juice, juice," which got Keaton excited for the role.
Aww.
So, yeah. So, with regards to the acting, What do you think to the cast that we ended up with?
Well, I can see I kind of made a note of it this time around. I can definitely see how this was blatantly the film that got Michael Keaton the gig as Batman when Tim Burton was was tasked with directing that, because it kind of shows his range. And obviously, you know, he's not going to play either Bruce Wayne or Batman as Beetlejuice, but it shows that he can do this almost transformative thing. And never more emphasized, I think, than the scene that Adrienne referenced earlier, where he lapses briefly back into regular Michael Keaton for like one brief scene of when they're asking him his credentials. And he's like, "Well, I studied for 10 years at Juilliard," and whatever else. And sounds like Michael Keaton himself, and then goes back into the Beetlejuice character. And it's such a unashamed performance, because you could quite easily pitch that. It's so over the top. You could quite easily pitch that really badly and it come off horrendous, because it's so different and so like large of a performance, if that makes sense. But I think it's just right. It was either going to be ridiculous and mocked forever or become iconic, and thankfully it was the latter.
Yeah, I mean, it's astounding that, as I say, he was only in it for 14 minutes, and he is so memorable that, yeah. But so is he the MVP for you in this one, would you say?
Well, it's weird because I don't know how they marketed it at first, because, like I say, I didn't really come to the movie till a bit later, but on the 4K that I watched, it's got on the front cover and on the menu, it literally says Michael Keaton is Beetlejuice. And then the menu cuts off, like, you know, Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis. So I'm like, huh, it's weird to think that, like, when it came out, were they aware of that? Or was it more of a, like, ensemble thing? Or was it more like you would think that Baldwin and Davis were the leads? I don't know.
I always got the impression, and again, you know, I didn't come to it until a little later, but I always got the impression that it was an ensemble, and because of his performance, they kind of promoted it, especially when he did get the gig as Batman later on. Yeah. So, yeah, what about you, Vianne? You got any standout moments, standout characters, favorites?
You know, it's so hard to say because it's such a talented group. Like, group they have meshed so well. I will say I've read some criticism of Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin in this. Oh, they're so boring and they're very bland. But I think that's by design. I mean, you have to have that. Again, just like I was talking about the juxtaposition of the everyday with the palette and angles of the afterlife in terms of visual design, you need that also. You can't have... You know, Batman doesn't work without the Joker and vice versa. You know what I mean? You have to have calm, steady, every day so that these other characters can be larger than life. You have to break it up. So I would say everybody in it is wonderful. For me personally, Michael Keaton is amazing. Catherine O'Hara and the late, great Glenn Shadix as well. But everybody in it is fabulous.
I always saw it that the Maitlands represented the kind of almost 1950s nuclear family and everything, and yet the Dietz family, you know, it's a stepmother, not a real mother. Ooh, shocking. It's pitched as this idea of, you know, they are the family that Lydia should have, the very traditional American values, you know, family, and not this newfangled thing, which again feeds into my kind of concept of the very 80s idea of, ooh, times are changing, and it's a bit weird. Yeah, maybe that's just me. I don't know.
Fair enough. Adrienne?
For me, the character who held this whole thing together was Lydia. So I actually give it to Winona Ryder. I think that she probably, you know, she had so many scenes. She had a lot to do, you know. And I think one of the things about Alec Baldwin's character is I think anybody could have played Adam. He really kind of disappeared in it. Even in the end, it was Gina Davis who wrote in the sandworm. As I was watching it, I just I couldn't take my eyes off Catherine O'Hara. Yeah. She's just such a scene stealer. She's such a great actress. And it was a hard choice between those two. But Michael Keaton brings the humor. So what are you going to do? He was hilarious, to be honest. And creepy.
I have to agree with you on Catherine O'Hara. I was genuinely shocked when I realized that she was the same person that plays the mom in Home Alone. And was like, what?
Oh, yeah. She's incredible. And she's a great singer, musician. You know, she's just an incredible actress. So and you know, like watching her acting, how she would not look at Lydia in these scenes. Like she talks to Lydia with her eyes closed with this smarmy look. And I'm like, oh, I bet you she actually hated Delia at the beginning, you know, you know, Delia comes around.
There's a bit of a fairy tale thing there as well, because I've made a note of, like, she's literally the wicked stepmother for the heroine. And yeah. I'm like, is there a tiny bit of, you know...
Right. You know,
Tim Burton likes this kind of twisted fairy tale idea, so who knows, maybe.
Yeah, but he also brought in the biblical references with Beetlejuice being sneakish and having snakes and tempting the Gina Davis character and... The Adam, you know, the name Adam, like Adam and Eve, and he literally lives under a tree. So I mean, there's all these kind of creation things at the beginning.
Cool. But no, I have to agree with you all on Winona Ryder. It was one of my very first crushes, and it's amazing because I had a quick look through Letterboxd to see like how this film was received, and 90% of the reviews are just men just drooling over goth Winona Ryder.
Oh god, that's kind of creepy, to be fair.
I mean, yeah. Men who were younger at the time, in fairness, it's just kind of like, this was
their kids at the time, yeah. You know, right.
This was my awakening. Oh, I can't believe, I'd want to marry Goth Widow Rider too, blah, 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 et cetera.
No, the red dress, though. Oh, these costumes were great in this movie, by the way, if I didn't mention that earlier.
So do you think that, with regards to the acting, they nailed the cast? I mean, Fiance mentioned that, you know, it was interesting if they could have gone a certain direction. But do you think there was anybody in this that kind of let the production down, or did they all hold their own?
I mean, I think Geoffrey Jones let himself down in various other ways, but we'll not.
We'll not go into that.
But yeah, best not discuss that, and don't Google it, whatever you do.
Yeah, I know all that stuff is.
No, I mean, apart from that, even the minor roles. I mean. Again, I'm always shocked to see like Robert Goulet appears in this movie, and it's like, oh yeah, he was in it. Yeah.
Well, the character of Juno, played by Sylvia Sidney, who, by the way, back in the 20s was absolutely stunning. If you want to look at her images, I remember when I first saw it, like being, saying to myself, why is she being so mean to the Maitlands? Because, you know, they're nervous, they're scared. Why didn't they make her a nice character? But watching it this time, I thought, well, actually, that's perfect, because she's overwhelmed. She's an overwhelmed bureaucrat. And I did not get until recently the whole that if you commit suicide, you become a bureaucrat in the
a civil
servant in the afterlife. Yeah. And of course, if you look at those scenes, they're all like suicide, and they talk about, well, I wouldn't have had my little accident. Yep. You know, like they just putting it together after watching it a million times.
So yeah, you mentioned Winona Ryder's red dress, Adrian. So that brings it to the production design. What are your thoughts with regards to how this thing looks? I mean, obviously, as Vian mentioned, it's part of his artistic vision. Mm-hmm. But how do you think, when it came to realizing it, how do you think it all comes together?
I just think that's one of the things that keeps the movie so great, is that production design. I think it's wonder. I think every single thing had been touched and made perfect. You know, think of all the different sets, all the different things they had to do, all the different brains they had to pick to make it come through like that. I love it.
Cool. Bian?
Oh, I think it's amazing. If you go back and look at any, you know, history of Tim Burton's art and work, he always does a lot of paintings, drawings, sketchings, that kind of thing, and provides them to the production team. So if you go back and look through his history, you know, you can see some of the archetypes and some of the design elements from his own work and how they translated that directly into the film in this case, more so, I think, than any other film he's worked on, really, really visually, to go from the page to the screen. They translated it quite literally from his artwork. So I love it. And I was actually just thinking, I'm sitting here next to a sandworm as we speak. So like, I've got a sandworm doll up on the shelf, and it got me just thinking. And I remembered for the first time in many years, I actually had a Beetlejuice coloring book.
Wow.
Back in the 80s, it was my favorite coloring book. So yes, even then I loved the design, and I really think it stands up, even though, you know, we can tell the picture of that and everything, but I think it's part of the charm.
Apparently it was always his intention to make the effects work similar to that of the B movies he grew up with, and he said he wanted to make the effects look cheap and purposely fake looking.
But they do look fake looking. That's the thing. They do look that way, which makes it a Tim Burton movie, which makes it so great. And what about the set of the town up in the attic? I mean, that was so neat.
It's beautiful. I'm a sucker for anything for models and crap like that. I would be like Adam. I would have that in my eye.
Yeah.
Have one other design element I wanted to think that I think is, it's very subtle, but I think it's one of the better design elements of the film, is when they're going through the afterlife corridor and they see the lost souls. The spirits that have been exercised, and when they're being summoned later in the movie when Barbara and Adam are being summoned later in the movie and they're being exercised, the makeup they put on them starts to make them look like those lost souls from earlier in the movie. And I love the way they did that.
He's good.
Yeah,
mine.
I never picked up on that. That's quite clever. I just have a few like random notes about like the direction and the visuals and kind of stuff, if you'll indulge me. Just things that I noted when I was watching it. So starting off with like the first scene being the giant spider on the model house, I thought was an instant setup for this being like the suburban meets the sinister idea. I love the design of like what is apparently Saturn, the sandworm place.
Yeah.
Such a cool, unique, trippy idea and a great visual, even if it does look like the trapdoor, which is a reference that's going to mean absolutely nothing to either of our guests, but hopefully...
Luke, where's my dinner?
Thank you. I was hoping you would know what I referred to by that.
The great Willie Rushton.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, man, I used to love that as a kid. But anyway, all of the kind of... like when it's supposed to look happy and nice and, you know... white picket fencey, the blue sky background visuals are all really stunning. Like Tim Burton can do a really good, imitation of bright and happy. And to that end, like, I've got no idea why it should be this way, but that one wall where it's just a wall, not connected to any other walls that they're sat in front of with like a window that's cut out with no glass in or anything. And it's just, you can
I
just
love
see
that. I would totally sit out there.
It just looks so cool with like the clouds and the sun behind it, and then you're just like, why is there one freestanding wall? It's so weird, but it looks cool. I like the reveal of Lydia when she's walking through the like fumigation smoke, as if it's like revealing the, you know, the star of the show almost. What else? Oh, and I love how, as much as I don't love a lot of the practical effects, I kind of love how they make all the causes of the death visible on the people that have died, which I suppose makes sense as to why, the two lead characters drowned, because you wouldn't have to go putting on any prosthetics or worrying about what it would look like. But yet, just everything from, like you said, the really burnt guy who would obviously like smoked and set himself on fire, the woman who slit her wrists, or even that moment when Juno smokes and then like it starts pouring out of the wound in her throat.
Yes. So her trachea. I first, of course, I thought that was a tracheotomy.
Yeah, but maybe it is.
I did read that they were going to have the Maitlands just look wet all the way through, but they stopped it because they didn't want them to be uncomfortable during shooting.
True.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they could have made them look a bit, pallid or whatever. But anyway,
the shoes could have been wet. They could have left wet footprints. That would have been cool.
Yeah. Fair enough. But no, I think other than that, like I said, just the special effects, like you said, I feel bad criticizing them, but they are kind of very, stop motion plasticine. But if Tim Burton claims that was the intent, then fair enough. I don't hate them. It's just they seem instantly dated, basically. So, yeah.
In fairness, they only had $1 million for special effects, so that could have had some bearing on the decision also.
Yeah. I still think some of the ideas are really cool. Like, even though it looks fake and it's kind of weird, the idea of when they start stretching their faces into those weird creatures and stuff, it's such a bizarre idea that I'd never have thought of. And you just kind of have to say, I'm not sure if this is genius or madness, but it's memorable.
I like the one at the start where they open the closet door and she's hanging there and just peels her face off.
Yeah, that was one of the more effective, definitely. Scared the crap out of me as a kid when I watched it.
And how funny is it that they never show us the scary face that Beetlejuice makes when he's showing the Maitlands he can be scary. And that makes it even more interesting.
Because you can see from behind the like snakes and stuff.
Yeah, but of course, I mean, to me, he showed them, tell them Large Marge sent you, or something like that.
But it did win the 89 Oscar for Best Makeup. I don't know if any of you guys know, when he turns into that merry-go-round, did you see the little head on top of his hat?
Jack Skellington!
Yep.
Love it, love it, love it.
So, does anyone have anything else to do with regards to the production design, or do you want to, all right, to move on?
I want to make a note of how iconic like the fashions and stuff became. Like the Beetlejuice look is so instantly recognizable that you can sell knockoff, Halloween costumes that are like pervy ghost man, and they're just black and white striped suits and the green wig, and it's like, yeah, we know exactly who you're referring to, you know what I mean? So yeah,
but you could also do Adam, you know, Adam Maitland, just a pair of khaki pants and a black and white checkered shirt.
Oh yeah, then like you said, like Lydia, the goth veil in black or the red wedding dress.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Any yuppie kind of stuff and hairstyle Catherine O'Hara has in the movie, you know, pretty good.
So we'll come to the sound design. This one, I mean, it's definitely one of his Elfman's most iconic. You instantly know the motifs when you hear them, what movie this is from. So I'm just wondering if there's, you know, if you guys have got anything with regards to the sound, and not just Elfman's score, but, you know, the Harry Belafonte and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, there is a funny little thing that my husband and I laughed so much about when we first met, because you never know when you first get together with somebody what they know. And one time I was being really goofy and I did the Beetlejuice dance from when he sees the, shall we say, house of ill repute, and he starts dancing and it's like, and he's doing all these funny moves and scooting along the floor. And I just love that whole scene. I just think it's great. And the music that's behind it, it's kind of techno-ish. It's kind of, you know, very, I don't know, just goofy, but creepy, but like a club, a little bit raunchy, you know, just put it all together. It's Beetlejuice.
What about you, Vian?
I have no criticism whatsoever. I think the sound design is perfect for what they do. I think it's very understated compared to the visuals, which I think was necessary, and the score is perfect.
Nice one. Mike?
Yeah, I don't really have a criticism. I just, I noted that, like I said, I thought it was really clever the way that they use Calypso music, which clashes with the idea of like the almost pseudo horror and the goth aesthetic and stuff, when you've got this incredibly bright, cheerful, you know, island of paradise, sunny place music playing, which is just, it was such a clever juxtaposition and it really worked.
Yeah, so, it does. Super.
I just can't picture Adam Maitland being a fan of Calypso music. I have a hard time reconciling that.
Yeah. Maybe it's Gina Davis's music.
Maybe.
I do.
Barbara's music.
A slightly funny story about that as well, which is that when they were announced that Beetlejuice 2 or Beetlejuice Beetlejuice was coming out, and there hadn't yet been a trailer, somebody on social media had said, you do realize that given the current trend, what they're going to do is they're going to come up with a trailer with a slowed down version of the Banana Boat song. And everyone was like, this is completely ridiculous. And then that's literally exactly what the trailer was when it came out like 2 weeks later.
Well, that's funny. Wow.
Well, obviously, as we said, the, you know, it was so successful, it went on to spawn, you know, action figure lines and animated cartoon, which, as Mike said, is just freaking weird. They did have plans for a sequel, which was Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian.
Must we go tropical?
Yeah, the script was commissioned. Keaton and Winona Ryder both signed on, but then Tim Burton just got bored and lost interest and went on to direct Batman and its sequel.
Wow.
So, if you've never seen Kevin Smith discussing being asked to do Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, I recommend looking at her. That was what I referenced earlier. He was like, did we not see all we needed to in the first Beetlejuice? Must we go tropical?
So, yeah, I mean, do you think it stands out as a cult classic, or do you think it's just a movie of its time?
I think it's just a regular classic. I'm not sure why it gets cult status, because it was a commercial success.
Yeah.
It has been and continues to be a commercial success. It's instantly recognizable. It's not niche. It's been part of the mainstream ever since it came out. So I think it's just a plain old classic.
Nice one.
Well, we'll not put it out.
Yeah. Adrian.
I think it's because it's so different and unusual and quirky. I think that's what makes it different than a regular classic. It's all the little quirks. And I think that that's why we love it so much, because it's quirky and it's, you know, classic, and it's, you know, it is kind of in with the mainstream. So I don't know if I'd call it cult. I just call it, you know, what it is. It's it just sort of became like a genre, Tim Burton's movies, you know, his stuff. It's like it became a Tim Burton thing. If you like Tim Burton, you usually like this one.
Yeah. Mike?
Not to, not to differ from our two guests, but I do think it's a cult classic. And I think it's things like you said, what they did with a low budget, or the idea of them not really casting at the time the biggest actors in the world or a star name, and relying on kind of an improvised performance, or the way that it looks very Tim Burton in that authorial style. I think it's not all that mainstream. It's not necessarily, it was popular enough to have become accessible, but I don't think it necessarily was initially thought of that it would be. And you know, it doesn't look like any other movie unless you're looking at Tim Burton's movies, you know. And it kind of stands out for me. And yeah, for me, that's kind of what makes it a bit of a cult film, and a bit of a, you know, if you like it, I think it kind of says a lot about your particular taste. Likewise, if you dislike it, you might just, you know, there'll be things here that you don't like that are just, whether it be visual or the, you know, the nature of the storytelling, the dark humor, whatever. But yeah, that's where I stand on that one.
I think it's like we discussed the other day, pretty much anything at some point can be considered a cult classic. We reviewed, Ghostbusters earlier this year, and it was a tremendous success, but it's still referred to as a cult classic. And I think it's kind of where this one, I think, lies, because this, you know, as our other guests have said, it was a commercial success. It's just that it's got those particular quirks about it, but do the quirks make a cult classic? So
I always thought that the reason a movie was a cult classic, like Rocky Horror, was because there's a huge following.
Yeah.
When people get together and they're going to watch this movie, like it's got an actual following. And I don't know if this one does, but I mean, I guess all the other
Tim Burton in general does, sort of, you know.
Yeah, that's
Tim
true.
Burton does.
Fanboys and fangirls and people that are specifically looking for that aesthetic. And like I said, if you look at, I think that's one of the things you can tell people are disappointed more and more by, because there's no real vision in a lot of the more recent Tim Burton, like I said, Gunfire stuff, where it's like anybody could have made this. Do you know what I mean? It's not, it doesn't stand out in any real way. It's just kind of drab.
Yeah. There seems to be a marked difference to me between watching this as a Tim Burton movie and watching something like Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
Alice in Wonderland's like somebody doing a bad Tim Burton impression, which is weird.
Yeah, hate that one. Hate that. I probably hate that as much as you hate Planet of the Apes.
Literally every remake except Dumbo that Tim Burton has done. So Planet of the Apes, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and that one, all terrible.
Cut out for some, were you talking about Alice in Wonderland?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that movie sucks.
Yeah. We have a consensus.
Okay.
So, as far as this one goes, what's your favorite thing? Is there a standout moment, scene, any particular aspect, aesthetic, anything technical? And I'll ask you first, Mike.
A few things stand out for me, like I said, from when I first watched it. And one of them is definitely always going to be that kind of childhood crush on Winona Ryder's character. Which, you know, it's undeniable it was there. I think, like I said, the idea that Michael Keaton was a bit of a revelation when, you know, people mock, but when he was cast as Batman, even people hadn't really, you know, accepted this movie, I don't think, is quite of a, you know, proof of his acting skills. So it was all Mr. Mom playing Batman. And I think this, you know, a lot of people were shut up when they found this performance. But for me, my favorite thing in it, because I think it just exemplifies the whole thing in one scene, is definitely the banana boat scene where they're possessed. They don't know what they're doing, but they have to be really into it. And it's hilarious. It's funny, but it's dark. It ends with them, you know, hands busting out of their food and you're pulling them down under the table. And it's just like, yep. If you want to ask me like what encapsulates what this movie is, that sort of scene, I think, says it all.
Yeah. I've got to agree with your second point, Keaton. To me, it's got to be Keaton. I mean, yeah, screen time's minimal, but it made the guy, basically. Adrian?
You mean my favorite actor?
No, your favorite kind of thing about the movie, whether it's an actor or a scene or anything.
Really. Oh, yeah. I do sort of give it to Keaton's extravagant showboatiness of developing this character. Like, I don't know what it would have been like on the set. I always want to know, but like just him cutting loose and setting free and like what the movement, you know, the way he was using his voice and all his, I mean, he just must have really either set people off or they just loved it. So I say it's his work that brings it all together on that level.
Interesting. Bian?
The design element for me, it's such a huge impact on my own artistry, I think, especially the really hard, uneven angles of things. That's, you know, visually the afterlife scenes and when they come back and Delia's sculptures and like Mike was talking about earlier, the patio that has the one wall that's not connected. Like I live in that house. I absolutely love every aspect of the design element of the, not the everyday, but the extraordinary.
What did you think out there? As always, we asked you for your input and you didn't let us down. So with her actually being in the studio with us this time, I'm going to hand this over to Vian to let us know what you think on this one.
Not a ton of feedback on this, surprisingly, because it is such a hit and everybody, I don't know a person who doesn't like this movie to some degree. So I was surprised there wasn't a ton of feedback. Beverly Ann Red says, I loved it as a kid, but it's been years since I've seen it, despite the fact that I own the DVD. I keep meaning to rewatch it if my child ever gives me any time to myself. So hopefully Beverly got time to watch it. Mike Whaley, 5 damn stars. It's still one of my favorite movies. And that was all caps there. Ian Skin, Beetlejuice is one of those films I liked but never loved. And I'm a big fan of majority of Tim Burton's movies. The whole concept was cool. And the main story arc of Davis and Baldwin's characters set off on a good path. I just think the film gets a bit too mad towards the end and never really reaches the point of a decent ending for me personally. It gets a bit too cartoon-like. Ian, how does it feel to be wrong about everything? let's see. Kieran Martin Walker says, I'd say 5 stars. I enjoyed it as a kid and still enjoy it to this day. Still to this day, I can't stop laughing at the nice fucking model bit as I read that it was ad-libbed by Keaton as the model tree wasn't supposed to have been knocked down so easily. I don't make me laugh my ass off. Okay. Great. And their characters like Winona as Lydia Dietz, Gina Davis and Alec Baldwin as Barbara and Adam, and especially Keaton as Beetlejuice. I also believe this was the film that helped Keaton get the role as Batman the year after. It was. He is correct. Patricia Durr, 5 stars, awesome. Stacey Louise Hillhouse, 5 stars. I love Beetlejuice. Paul Kane, 5. We love it. Big smiley face. So, mostly really positive feedback.
Nice one.
Nice fucking model.
So, cheers for that, Vian, and for that little sound clip, Mike. And thank you to everyone of you.
Oh, and that bit has gotten edited out so many times. So many times. When this came out on VHS in the 80s and 90s, that little part was edited out. They didn't re-put it in until, I think, in the early 2000s and on the DVD release.
Well, I think in the UK it was left in, wasn't it, Mike?
I've never not known it.
Even the groin grab? Was
yep.
that part there? Yeah.
Yep. I remember it always being
there. Yeah. So, thank you to every one of you that sent us your opinion. As always, if you missed out on letting us know, you're free to drop your thoughts on this episode on any of the socials, which we'll flash up later. So, with that in mind, it's time to ask our guests for their final thoughts on this one. And if you've been with us before, you know the score by now. Final thoughts and a score out of 5. So, Adrienne, I'm coming to you first on this one.
I love this movie. It's a happy go-to movie for me. I was a little bit disappointed that this time I saw some of the creepiness up close, but when back in the day it was supposed to be that way. He's a creep. He's gonna do creep things. So I give this a 4 out of 5 stars.
Okay.
Again, apologies for the long-winded conclusion. I know I say it a lot, but I try and break these down, and they never get any shorter. So I'll say a good and enjoyable movie that's really selling itself on the Burton aesthetic, which is really evident and gorgeous here, and a Keaton performance that surprised everyone, though it's Winona Ryder who young me related to and who was the biggest draw of the movie. The practical effects are almost charming. Okay, they mostly look pretty shoddy, but it kind of fits with the tone and theme of the piece. It isn't a horror movie after all, but more a fun celebration of the macabre and mortality, which makes it a perfect Halloween watch that I've indulged in many times. Being critical, there's some questionable things that wouldn't fly now, mainly around Beetlejuice's impropriety and Lydia openly expressing being suicidal. It's also very slight. At a brisk 90 minutes, it moves at a great pace, but it leaves the thing feeling less impactful and more of just a fun romp. There are plot holes, but criticizing them just seems silly in a film that is almost a fairy tale fantasy. It's nice seeing when Burton was a good director, so just enjoy the fun ride, the eye candy, and the kooky dark humor, but don't expect to think too hard about any of it or be all that affected, though admittedly Lydia may have affected my taste in women a bit over the years, and I give it 3.5 out of 5.
Okay. Nice. Yep. What about you, Vian? What's your ultimate verdict on this one?
For me, this is almost the penultimate Tim Burton movie. It's up there with Edward Scissorhands as something that this is as Tim Burton as it gets. And I love that about it. I love it visually. And for me, it's summed up, you know, it's the perfect merging of the visual and the idea of the light within the darkness, right? And the part we've already discussed a little bit where Beetlejuice shows Barbara and Adam that he can be scary, but we don't see it. But their reaction to him, I think that just sums up the whole movie right there. And I love it.
Cool. And what's your score out of 5?
Oh, 5 out of 5 for sure.
5. Wow.
Wow.
Okay. So I'll give mine. It's a fun hour and 30 minutes. The cast understands the assignment, the direction's competent, and the effects work is pretty decent stuff. Keaton's on fire in the role of Beetlejuice, and it's easy to see why he both steals the show with his limited screen time and why he went on to become such a household name. Honestly, though, it's occasionally a little too Tim Burton for me in places, and while it can be visually interesting, for me, it does have a tendency to be excessive. To the point I feel like the Maitlands in some respect. But personal preference aside, it's a good, solid movie, and I will be getting my tickets for the sequel, and I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5.
Wow.
So
you know, that makes the final score exactly on the nose.
Yes. So by averaging all of the scores, it gives Beetlejuice that final cult classic score of 4 out of 5.
Yay.
That's good. Rarely happened before.
I'm really looking forward to the sequel too. I can't wait to go see it, to be honest.
Nice one. Yeah. I mean, how do you feel about the final score? Fair enough?
Yeah, I think so. Sure. Of course.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's a bad score. It's not the best, certainly not the worst. Yeah, that's it for this one. So all that remains, as always, is to thank my guests for jumping in. So Vian, thank you for joining us. Glad we managed to get you on an episode this season.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nice one. Have you enjoyed it?
Have I enjoyed? Of course. I always enjoy talking.
Oh, brilliant. Are you working on any projects at the moment that you want to promote? Anywhere the listeners can find you on your socials?
I am on most every social under Lady Vian, that's V-E-A-N, and nothing in particular I'm working on right now, except for a cookbook, but that's a story for a different day.
Oh, now I'm intrigued. So no worries on that. Adrienne, thank you once again for venturing in on this one.
Thank you. Thank you for the invite.
Anytime. Any socials listeners can
I have ventured back into my Twitter account, which is what it was called when I started. So I'm there at AL Park Tucker 2, and sorry for the politics.
No worries. Yeah, we'll make sure those links are in the description. Speaking of which, Mike, thank you once again for your presence on this.
You're very welcome. Thanks for inviting me to do it.
Anytime. I know you've got some good stuff lined up for us on coming episodes of Silver Screen Regular and Cinema Classics. I'll cover that in a moment. But for now, do you want to tell the listeners about our socials?
Yeah, you know the drill by now, DK. You'll have to start doing this yourself. But no, that's all good.
Oh, balls to that, dude.
You can find us at all the places that I'll edit onto the screen because I have a little you know, card that shows all of the social medias that we are on, where you can find me in the podcast. Or if you did want to try and get in touch with DK, I'll always pass that message on. And occasionally he pops in when he's, you know, been summoned from the afterlife. So yeah, you can also, if you aren't watching on YouTube and you can't see that up on screen, you can always find our link tree in the episode description that will direct you to all of those social medias as well. And as for me personally, I'm around. It's just usually my name.
So yeah, that's it for us. Thank you for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you here. And if you've enjoyed it, then don't forget to like, subscribe, and share the word. We really do love having you join us on these things. We'll see you next month for a slight change in format. It's October, and you know what that means? Halloween. And to celebrate, we'll be having our very first Silver Screen Month of Monsters. Maybe the last, we don't know. Ooh. Where we'll be having a channel-wide crossover and looking at all things that make the season go with a shudder. Beginning with a certain character, and all I'll say on that one is, over to you, Mike. I do like the added effect there of you actually making a building fall over midway through. Yeah, be sure to join us to hear what's happening, and we'll accompany you into Samhain. Until then, keep watching the skies, dear cultists, and remember, in heaven, there wouldn't be dust on everything.
You have been listening to the Cult Classics Show, part of the Silver Screen Podcast. Created, written, and hosted by DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Feedback section produced by Lady VN. Opening credits by Ian Sanderson. Music by Timeless Journey. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found on our link tree. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network, available wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you next time. And remember, no matter where you go, there you are.